Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 3:20 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is Friday, and it is June 9th. So it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Well, I thought we'd kick off with Microsoft, and the share rebounded exceptionally impressively over the last 3 months, and it's now back in the region of the all-time high. So it does beg the question: is $350 as high as it's going to go? Or are we going to see just a mild consolidation before it breaks on the upside, reasserts the secular bull market, and has the entire episode of the last 2 years just been a blip on the long-term outlook for world domination? So obviously, there's a lot riding on that. Well, what would be required in order for Microsoft to double from here? It's at 326 right now. So then let's just look at the market cap. And the market cap is 2.4 trillion. So let's just imagine, what would it take for the Microsoft to get to 5 trillion? Well, they could sell a lot. And this is, of course, one of the issues, because the price to sales ratio is already at nearly 12. So if they're going to sell a lot, then that would help to justify the current price. So they're going to have to sell a lot more than is currently envisaged. And then they're going to have to keep doing that for the foreseeable future. Now, I have noticed that there's a little icon has appeared on my Microsoft Outlook, and it is helping to be predictive in how I write emails. So that is an application of artificial intelligence, which Microsoft has embraced with both arms and is running with it. And they are acting like a startup in that regard. And that would certainly be required if they're going to generate the kind of sales necessary to justify the valuation, such as it is right now. Then there is the other question, and it's about the size of available cash. If the market cap is going to jump from 2.5 to 5 trillion, well, it would be a lot easier if the volume of cash in the market was also going to increase by a commensurate number. So we would need to see at least a doubling of money supply. Well, then, just on a monetary inflation basis, that would allow the price to double, but it wouldn't necessarily mean that the company is generating double the value. So there is reason to think that that is not an outlandish possibility, because we've seen plenty of examples where the size of the Fed's balance sheet has doubled during crises. So back in 2008, it doubled. And then in 2012, it didn't quite double, but it went up by over a trillion. And then during the pandemic, it went from 4 to over 8 trillion. So then that was more than a double. So we do have periods of time where it contracts. And generally speaking, periods of quantitative tightening, such as we have now and what we had in 2018-19, they cause stress in the market. They cause stress in the financial system, particularly within the money markets, cause the kinds of problems that the Federal Reserve doesn't have much choice but to intervene in. And then that sets the stage for the next potential economic problem, which is greeted with massive monetary accommodation. Now, of course, the big difference on this occasion is that we have inflation. So then, if one is to believe that the most likely scenario in any impending recession is going to be massive monetary accommodation, where the size of the Fed's balance sheet is going to go from perhaps 8 trillion to over 16 trillion, then that would be in response to a big downside economic surprise But then also, it would be an admission that inflation is no longer something that anyone needs to worry about. Now, one thing that I think is rather interesting here is if we look at the ratio of the VIX to the MOVE index, we're given a rather interesting chart. And the more back history we look at, the more interesting it gets. So the VIX has been falling, despite the fact that the stock market has mostly been going sideways for the last 2 weeks, and it has bounced over the last 2 days. But over the last 2 weeks, it hasn't really gone anywhere. The VIX index has been going down. And the MOVE index has been really stubborn in not going down very much. So then the spread between the two has been contracting, and it got all the way back down. And I will look at this on just a daily chart now and perhaps pull in more of the back history so that we can see just how low it got in historical terms. But I think the most important point is that this is a very depressed level. Volatility on the stock market is exceptionally low, and this spread, or its ratio, excuse me, has come down to levels that haven't been seen since about 1994, or I guess 95. So that's a really quite extraordinary contraction and a huge divergence between the performance of the VIX and the performance of the MOVE index. Now, it is also true that troughs in the VIX are less an indicator of market tops than peaks are of market bottoms. But when you get volatility at such low levels, one does have to beg the question, well, what exactly is going on? And it does look like that investors are willing to price in that we're going to see inflation collapse. There won't, and then on top of that, that's basically what the bond market is pricing in. And that's why bond yields haven't been rising, despite the fact that inflationary pressures have been rather sticky. And the 10-year yield is still hovering here around 3.75%. But the Fed funds rate is in excess of 5% and is likely to rise at least once more. So we have very inverted yield curves. So the stock market is pricing in the potential that interest rates are going to come down because inflation is not going to be a problem anymore. And that's basically what the bond market is pricing in. But what the stock market is also pricing in is that there won't be any repercussions, that there won't be an impact on corporate earnings, that consumer activity is going to be robust, and that if there is a recession, it'll be a recession in name only. So that's a very bullish way of thinking about it, and I think it is not it's not particularly realistic. It seems to be rather Pollyanna-ish. But the then let's also think about the total return on these on the 10-year bond. So let me make sure that I get this up. And what we've seen here is that because this is a total return index, it has rebounded over the course of the last 6 months. It has not been able to push back above the long-term moving average, and this looks like a completed top formation. So I've been long of TLT now for a couple of months, and it's been in and out of the money. And I guess I'm picking up dividends along the way, but that's not really particularly comforting. It's simply going sideways, and by going sideways, it is unwinding that oversold condition relative to the 1,000-day moving average. I believe that there will be a deflationary shock. I think that inflation is going to surprise on the downside at some point this year, that there will then be demand for bonds as a hedge against a deflationary environment, and I don't think that stocks are going to be immune from it. But that perspective is running contrary to the kind of activity that we've seen in the market. So we've seen a really significant pop on the upside for the mega cap companies. And if we look at the ratio of the eight largest companies, which are Apple, Amazon, and Alphabet, Microsoft, Nvidia, Netflix, Tesla, and I'm leaving one more out. I did say Microsoft, and well, Meta. There we go. So this ratio has got all the way up to the peaks. It now represents 23% of the entire market cap of the NYSE, and I really did not think that this was a likely outcome. And I remember at the beginning of the year, I was writing about what the surprises of 2023 would be. And there was most the consensus at the time was that the market would go down in the first half and would potentially rally in the second half. So I thought that perhaps the surprise would be that it would go up in the first half and down in the second half. And that is probably going to, that's looking like a more likely scenario right now. We've had this spectacular rally. Interest rates have continued higher. Bond yields are stubbornly high. And yet we've had this inflation of valuations. So we are in the very definition of a bubbly environment. And bubbles are characterized by manias, by the wholehearted belief that we are going to have a benign outcome where valuations don't matter, where interest rates don't matter, where debt burdens don't matter, because whatever it is we're interested in right now is going to solve every problem that humanity has ever come up with. So that's artificial intelligence. And the thing that I find most particularly interesting is that artificial intelligence has been around for a while. And there was a great deal of enthusiasm around artificial intelligence about 7 or 8 years ago. And then a couple of years ago, I guess it was before the pandemic, we had Google very briefly trialed its automatic dialer. So you could ask Android to make a restaurant reservation for you, and they would literally have an AI call the restaurant and make the reservation. This isn't a kind of a Yelp or an OpenTable type of operation where you just fill in your details online. They literally had a computer making the phone calls. So that was poo-pooed immediately. The media didn't like it, and it was shelved. And Google basically sat on the sidelines. Now we have lots of really interesting stories. We have people that are talking about the end of humanity, that we're all going to be made obsolete, that the robots are going to take over. And then you had this really incredible story earlier this week where it was a Navy colonel, I believe, who opined that has any just basically said, has anybody thought about what would happen if perhaps an AI-driven drone that suddenly had its operator trying to get it to change, and then it decided that the best way to ob achieve its objective was to get rid of the operator so it kills the operator. And that was then taken up and run with the media and reported as fact that it had already occurred. So then there was mass hysteria about, oh my gosh, artificial intelligence is taking over. And then there was a lot of people had egg on their face because it didn't in fact happen, and it was just somebody thinking about what might happen in such an eventuality. Then you had Marc Andreessen talking about how artificial intelligence has enormous promise and how it is going to be wonderful at spotting cancers in scans, more efficient than radiology. But I think that's it's a very clear possibility. I also know that that exact same piece of news came out more than 5 years ago. And that has been true of artificial intelligence for quite some time, that there are some repetitive tasks where one simply needs to have a trained eye that an artificial intelligence can perform better. So obviously that is something that is out there. But then I think we have the potential that artificial intelligence could spot the next killer asteroid, that it would be better at picking out details in large pieces of data. And that is most particularly true for scientific data, because scientific data is less subjective. And one of the biggest challenges that large language models have is that people lie, that people are ambiguous, and the kinds of data that it tends to get trained on is the broad internet, which is full of vitriol, racism, but then jokes. And from the perspective of an artificial intelligence, a joke and then a slangy way of talking, derogatory ways of talking that are viewed as fun, they are all reported as fact. So what it inevitably ends up doing is reporting in a way that exaggerates bias. And this is not a bug. It's a feature of the systems. And I don't know, is there anything that they can do about that? Because what it is going to require is a mass reprogramming. But I think the more important point is that we have real panic going on right now. And it is panic about what the future holds, how incredible the change is that is going to happen in our economies and in our lives, and there is real pressure underway to try and make sure that people have a position. So you have to at least do something, and that is irrespective of valuations. So Nvidia trades on a price to sales ratio of 37. And that is pricing in a lot of sales for a lot of time. And the share basically went vertical 3 weeks ago. And now it's pausing. But it's not declining. And hasn't really been pulling back in in a very dynamic manner. And I would then add the word yet to that sentence, because I think it is inevitable that people will eventually start to feel that a lot of value is already in the price. But then we're still in an environment where these large cap companies can have surprising results. And Tesla, for example, gapped higher in here today. And I thought it was really interesting how the news was reported. So the main story is that GM is now going to use Tesla's supercharging network for its electric vehicles. And the way it was reported is that it's going to be a 3 billion fillip for Tesla. What is in the detail is that it could be spread over 10 years. So then it's going to be a benefit of perhaps 300 million a year for a company with a market cap of 775 billion. So that is not going to move the needle. Now, I think it is important to highlight that we're in an interesting environment. We have these short-term overbought conditions. We have real panic about trying to initiate positions in artificial intelligence. And a great deal of complacency because volatility has been so low. And low volatility, it allows algorithmic systems to increase their positions. And it is not simply that volatility has been low, but also that the volatility of that volatility has also come back down to test the lower side of its range. And that's an additional factor that allows artificial intelligence-led programs or automated programs to increase their positions as well. But we still have high interest rates, and we still have an environment where the Federal Reserve is worried about inflation. And they do have a target for what that inflation is. And right now, inflation or the core PCE rate is at 4.7%, and they want to get that down to between 2 and 3%. And the most important thing is that it hasn't been coming down aggressively. And I think that we have some really good pictures for what it should look like. So one thing that we've definitely seen over the last while has been that Latin American countries have been very aggressive in raising interest rates. And because they were so aggressive in raising interest rates, then inflationary pressures have rolled over and they're coming down fast. So Brazil's inflation peaked at around 12%, and now it's coming down below 4%. And Chile, inflation peaked above 12%, and now it's below 10%. And Mexico has also seen its inflation roll over at a lower level, and then is starting to come back down. And then Colombia is just beginning to see its inflation coming back down. So one thing we certainly know is that if central banks raise interest rates aggressively, then what they can do is get that inflation down. So Colombia now just about has positive real interest rates. The repo rate is at 13.25%. So they've raised rates very aggressively. Now let's just look at what that means for their currencies. That when you suddenly get positive real rates, so the Brazilian real has a positive real rate of nearly 10%. So Latin American countries, but most particularly Latin American administrations, this is not their first rodeo. This is not the first time they've had to deal with inflation that gets out of control. And they have an institutional memory about what they need to do in order to get that inflation down. But what they need to do is raise rates aggressively. They have to be willing to endure the potential that economic growth is going to roll over, that consumers are going to have a rather difficult time, and that as long as they're willing to do that, then the pain can be relatively short-lived. So the Brazilian real is now breaking higher and is trading north of the 1,000-day moving average. And there's been a really clear sequence of lower rally highs for the dollar. And then the Mexican peso has been among the strongest currencies in the world this year. And since the accelerated low back in 2020, it has done nothing but appreciate. And it's still appreciating. Then let's think about the Colombian peso. So if they've only just got their positive real interest rates, then we're starting to see now that the currency is also starting to appreciate. And I think there is a very strong likelihood that it is going to strengthen through that 1,000-day moving average. So I think that's a meaningful development. Then I think it's also rather interesting let me see if I can find this chart I was looking at earlier. And it's the composition of some of those markets. So It is interesting to just look at what exactly are you getting when you buy Mexico. Well, more than half the market is defensive, so you're going to be getting telecoms and you're going to be getting Walmart, for example. And then it's not particularly commodity based. So even though Mexico is a major commodity producer, a lot of it is nationalized. And what you're really thinking about is the flow down into the wider economy. But when you buy, for example, Colombia, and then you don't get any of the commodities either, but it's much more cyclically based, which means that in an economic environment where there is going to be lower interest rates, then it should respond much more favorably. Well, when you then think about Brazil, you're getting a little bit of everything, and it's one of the Latin American markets with the most commodity exposure within the actual market. Now, I put together an index back in November of this year, excuse me, of last year, and I thought it would be interesting to look at it once more. So, this is an equal weighted index combining the MSCI Mexico, India, Indonesia, and Nigerian indices. So it's redenominated then. These are all US dollar denominated indices, and it's equal weighted. And it did really exceptionally well between 2002 and 2007. And then not much of anything between about 2013 and 2022. But now it is breaking on the upside once more. So it does then, I think, reflect the transition. So we're definitely starting to see that wages in China have gone up. Now, all other factors being equal, that would suggest that there will be less manufacturing migration into China. Doesn't necessarily mean that manufacturing will disappear, but it does put pressure on Chinese businesses to move up the value chain, start producing stuff that has a higher margin. And that also, of course, means enhancing the productive capacity of each individual worker in order to justify those wages. And it means that any industry where that can't be achieved will migrate. And it's going to end up in any number of countries. But where is that going to be? Well, wherever it goes has to have a relative wage less than China, and has to have relatively free trade with the rest of the world. And it would be really handy if governance was pretty steady and the trend of infrastructure development was improving. And obviously, if you're going to be manufacturing, well, then energy prices being either subsidized by the government or reasonably low because you're an energy exporter, that would also be really beneficial. And then, of course, you have rising geopolitical tensions on top of that. And I think most companies now are still saying that they want to have trade with China. China is the second biggest market in the world and is a massive individual market for most companies. They will probably manufacture in China for the Chinese market, but they also want to have an alternative. So they're going to have a China plus one. And that one could be India because of the large young population and also the large internal market, the low wages that are also evident in India. And I think though that's enough of a pull. It could be Indonesia, large young population. Not as geographically cohesive, but certainly in the right neighborhood. Wages that are not as low as India, but not very high either. And then also a commodity producer. So an oil producer and natural gas, nickel, and then lots of agricultural commodities as well. Nigeria is an OPEC member. Huge young population, governance that is sadly lacking, corruption that is often out of control, but probably one of the most industrious groups of people around. One thing that I never cease to be amazed by is it doesn't matter where I go or which person I talk to. Whenever I meet someone from Nigeria, whether they are driving taxis or engaged in any kind of work, they are entrepreneurial. And I think that it will eventually contribute to a renaissance within the country because they have a clear business mindset. So I definitely wanted to include that. And it is also because the demographics are so favorable, and Nigeria is likely to become one of the major heavyweights within the African continent. But then I think Mexico is probably the country that's going to benefit most from however one wants to describe reshoring, nearshoring, friendshoring, or simply China plus one. And because it has a predictable relationship with the USA, particularly on the tariffs front because of the renegotiated NAFTA, it has a geographical proximity. And I think those are going to, and then of course there is a long relationship with US businesses doing business in Mexico, manufacturing in Mexico. So that's a well-trodden path. And that suggests to me that these markets are likely to be among the clear beneficiaries of trends as they evolve, where we have emerging market currencies breaking on the upside. Now, at the moment, that is limited to Latin American currencies because they have been the most aggressive in raising interest rates. And that is a testament to the institutional memory with inflation. Now, when we think about the Nigerian naira, for example, well, they still have work to do if they're going to arrest its decline. It's still breaking on the downside. And then the Indian rupee has been quite stable over the last 6 months, but it also needs to do more if we're going to see a stronger currency prevail eventually. And then the Indonesian rupiah has been quite volatile. And sorry, I didn't type that in correctly. It has been volatile over the last few years, but it is a trend of appreciation over the last 6 months. And I think it is likely that we're going to see more currencies appreciating versus the US dollar. But we're also seeing tighter credit conditions taking a toll on smaller countries. If you want to think about the major long term, I think that the debt question is likely eventually to cause a major war, and it will be between creditors and debtors, and whoever wins that war gets paid and or has their debts wiped out, and the losers from that war end up paying the debts or experiencing the debt deflation. So that is exactly what happened in Hungary, Germany, the Czech Republic after the First World War. They had the debt deflation, and of course, that also equated with hyperinflation. So there is obviously then the potential that in a future war, whoever loses will experience the debt deflation. And that could happen, and I think it is most particularly relevant because there are huge debt issues. We have the Chinese property market, where there is this just extraordinarily large volume of debt outstanding. Now, the CSI 300 was in positive territory in here today, but it really hasn't gone anywhere since 2015. And the Chinese administration, they're not particularly favorably disposed towards the stock market. Now, there's a I guess, a way of thinking about markets in that the Chinese government will always support property, the German government will always support debt, and the US government will always support the stock market because those are the relative priorities for the individual populations. But at the moment, at least, the Chinese government is not supporting the property market. And the kinds of measures that have been introduced so far have been fairly non-committal. We're definitely not seeing the same volume of cash being thrown at the problem, and property developers are still under a great deal of stress. There is a massive quantity of debt outstanding, and it stretches all the way from the individual consumer, where the income to price ratios are anywhere from about 25 all the way up to 45. And then you have the local governments, which rely on the land sales and the cozy relationship between local government, the banking sector, and property developers, where they all lend to each other. And then, of course, you have this massive inventory of houses that are held for investment purposes only, with nobody living in them, and then a clear incentive to ensure that construction continues so that the debt mountain will continue to rise. And the government is trying to prick that bubble, and they'd want to avoid a crash. But how can you avoid a crash if its liquidity has been cementing it? Well, they could introduce a property tax, and then that would probably initiate a crash because so much inventory would hit the market at the same time. And that would obviously have a deleterious effect. So they've been playing with it, but they haven't been able to do it. And then you can look at the debts in Europe, where you have elderly populations, generous social security pension promises that have been made, and a greater and greater proportion of government spending going to meet those obligations. You have the US, where the Social Security and Medicare are considered unfunded liabilities and completely beyond the pale in terms of discussions about budget security. And then the debt ceiling discussion was a pale comparison compared to what really is required in order to get the debt under control. And it will require much higher taxes, much less spending, more people willing to work, less supports, and completely beyond the capacity of politicians to even talk about at present. So, in a future war, one of those will get their debts wiped away, the others will end up paying the debts for everyone else, and that's generally how wars work. And considering how large those issues are, and how quick the pace of technological innovation has been, it does look likely that eventually that premise will get tested. But I don't think that it's going to happen immediately because you don't yet have the push factor. And I think eventually there will be a push factor, and that push factor would come in the form of a major economic problem for one of those blocks. And we're obviously challenged with coming up with what the catalyst will be. Now, it could be that China eventually loses its patience and invades Taiwan. And it could be that the USA moves into another big recession. And that the war in Ukraine goes badly for Europe, and that Russia's superior numbers and superior volume of armaments will eventually overwhelm the smaller Ukrainian force, despite the fact that they are better supplied. And I think it is rather interesting that the Russian market is still trading on the RTSI and rolling over here. So encountering resistance in the region of the 200-day moving average. At least to me, that suggests that investors are not willing to really give the benefit of the doubt to the Russian rhetoric that they have been able to weather the storm of sanctions relatively unscathed. Certainly, they've done better than many people thought was possible, but the longer those sanctions remain in place, the harder that is going to be. And we're in this difficult environment where interest rates have gone up, valuations are high, geopolitical tensions are rising, and yet the stock market persists in setting new highs or breaking out and holding moves to the upside. So that tells me that we are certainly in a bubbly environment. And with a bubbly environment, then one can stay long, and that one can make money faster than one is accustomed to. But the most important thing is not to be carried away by the swell of bullishness from the crowd, and to be particularly diligent about where stops are. And I think it is important. I looked at the mini index, and here is the ex-US market, so all ex-US relative to the US market, and it did pop on the upside from November of last year, but it has rolled over. That big rally in the mega caps has certainly been exceptionally powerful. It hasn't made new lows just yet. We're also at an interesting juncture here where the yield on the 10-year is now 200 basis points above where the yield on the S&P 500 is. And we haven't had that occur since, and certainly not for as sustained a period, since before the global financial crisis. So the yield on bonds is certainly attractive relative to the US benchmark. Now, I think it's worth considering here that with all this talk about reshoring and with manufacturing, that if we look at the industrial production adjusted for the purchasing power parity of the dollar, it's trending down and it has been trending down. But if we look at it in simply nominal terms, it is on the cusp of breaking to the upside. So, from a bull's perspective, this is confirmation that all of this building of manufacturing capacity is going to lead to a renaissance in terms of the basic manufacturing in the USA. Adjusted for purchasing power parity, this might really be more a reflection of the depreciation of the dollar. One thing that I think is a very interesting chart is that the number of hours worked in manufacturing is in fact rolling over. So that was a factor in the period from 2018 through 2019. It was also a factor in 2007. It was a factor in early 2000 where manufacturing started breaking on the downside. So this is potentially a lead indicator for slower economic activity or potentially a downside surprise, and it is certainly trending on the downside. Now, then I think this is also an interesting chart that we have had a good sized rebound in the number of people working in manufacturing over the last 2 years. It recouped all of the decline, and the number of people working in manufacturing has improved over the last decade. Of course, that was following a cataclysmic decline from immediately after when China was accepted into the WTO. But the other point is that the number of people working in manufacturing tends to be volatile, and during recessions, it goes down. And having added approximately 1.5 million jobs since 2020, there is clearly the potential that short time, which is what we saw in the last chart, where people are literally working fewer hours in the week, will eventually translate into more jobs being lost. And that's, I think, important to highlight because if we look at payrolls, then it broke on the upside in here this week. Don't think I have the right chart here, but we'll see in just a second. So that's not what I was looking for. It's not going to be unemployed. I'm sorry, I'm jobless claims. I do apologize. Jobless claims have popped on the upside, and I think it's particularly important to just take out the spike. To any technician, this is a base formation completion. And if we start to see manufacturing jobs being lost, then that's going to contribute to a significant pop on the upside here. You cannot have a recession without people losing their jobs. And I think that is potentially what we're going to start seeing now. Now, I think this is also important to highlight is that it is the yield curve spread that is one of the best lead indicators we have. And there are three phases to it. And the first phase is people are enthused because central banks are eventually are finally doing something to control inflation. And then markets can actually rally during the inversion. And that's exactly what we get. Eventually, you get fears that the tightening process has gone too far. But then it doesn't show up in economic activity, and you can still see the market rallying. But then you get the third phase, which is that there's clear evidence that the tightening has gone too far. And then you start to see interest rates getting cut, the yield curve spread starts to rally once more, and then it starts moving back up through zero. And central banks don't generally cut interest rates unless there is a problem. And we can pretty much identify what the problem is going to be, that eventually unemployment is going to start rising. Well, the Federal Reserve really only has two mandates, might even be too many. But they want to ensure maximum employment and they want to control inflation. Well, they're attempting to control inflation. They have not been as aggressive as Latin American countries in raising interest rates, so inflation hasn't been as compliant in contracting. But we've had an inverted yield curve for almost a year, and eventually it will catch up with the wider market. We also know that LIBOR is going to be retired at the end of June, so the financial sector is now scrambling to ensure that SOFR is going to be ready for purpose on June 30th. And when we get a shock to the system, then the reason why the technology sector is strong is they're betting that earnings will be immune and interest rates will fall anyway. And I think that that is just unlikely. But we should then think about, well, what is likely after that? Well, if we see the dollar index rolling over, I think that will not be too surprising. Now, the dollar index was a bit softer earlier in the week, finished the week a little bit steadier, still holding in the region of the 200-day moving average. There's a long-term cyclicality to the dollar, and it is well overdue for a significant bear market. And if it does move into a bear market and breaks down through 100, then that is likely to be a 7-year period of underperformance. It could take us all the way out to the end of the decade. Now, we're starting to see emerging markets performing, and I think that that is likely to be a significant secular trend, provided that the dollar does in fact roll over. And that is also why gold and emerging markets do tend to move together. Now, the price is still holding here around the 1960 level, and this continues to look like a consolidation in the region of the upper side of the 3-year range. And that would suggest that the breakout, when it comes, will be on the upside. And ranges being explosions waiting to happen, when it does break on the upside, it's likely to do so in a dynamic manner. But we're not quite there yet, and prices might yet fall potentially back towards the 200-day moving average, which would be approximately another $30 of volatility. When we think then about what will be the trends that will dominate over the next decade, we've definitely seen a lot of enthusiasm for the Green New Deals, and I think this week was a good example of how difficult that is going to be in fact. It's all well and good to sit around and self-congratulate and come up with really bullish plans for the future about how the world is going to be wonderful and utopian, and quite another to actually put them into effect. So, the EU, which has been certainly at the head of the effort to price carbon, to introduce taxes, and to try and force through an energy transition, well, it looks like they're not going to be able to pass the final piece of legislation, which would be to return 20% of the European land mass to pre-industrial conditions. And a good part of the reason for that is because people need to eat. So, soybean prices have popped on the upside in here. And this is a very deep short-term oversold condition. And well, let me see if I can put this up on without having the big gap in the chart, so we can see it more graphically on the second month continuation chart. Prices are starting to rally from the deep short-term oversold condition. Wheat prices are potentially now starting to bottom as well, and holding the upper side of that underlying base formation. Corn has been weaker and is bucking the trend somewhat, but on just the front month contract, it is at least holding the $5 level. But then it is also interesting that the kinds of soft commodities that are more focused on Asia are doing better. Sugar prices are now at highs that haven't been seen in a decade. And this consolidation remains underway, and it's unwinding the short-term overbought condition, but this is the highest level we've seen since 2012. Cocoa had been ranging for an exceptionally long period of time, and then it popped on the upside over the last 2 weeks. This is now coming back up into the region of the highs from 2014 and 15. And then Robusta coffee, which is more focused on Vietnamese supply, is also popping on the upside in here. This is the highest level we've seen for the contract. Now, Robusta coffee doesn't have as much back history because the contract was reformulated in 2008, but it is now at highs for this new contract. It's also worth highlighting that the lumber contract is no longer traded, so we don't have a ready way of pricing lumber any longer. But soft commodities are popping on the upside. And the UK also has failed to pass its own suggested Green New Deal, and the Labour Party, which has been championing the Green New Deal, is walking it back on the grounds that they can't afford it with their budgets. And I think this is going to be very much part and parcel of the broader environment. Now, we certainly have higher food prices, and these trends are persisting, and a new El Nino has just started. So that takes a while to affect the weather, but it does contribute to drier conditions in Asia, weaker monsoons, droughts in Australia, but then higher moisture conditions in the Americas. And I think that is likely to contribute to hysteria later in the year and next year about record global temperatures. But I think it is also worth reminding ourselves that one of the reasons why agricultural prices are so high is because of biodiesel. And because farmers are under pressure to produce less food. And that agricultural products are being deployed for biodiesel, which is creating an additional source of demand for foodstuffs. And the guilt cycle for humanity is in overdrive right now. Now, I think this is also evidence of a mania, but there's nothing stopping it just yet, and it continues. Now, natural gas prices were a bit steadier in Europe in here today, and this is coming from very depressed levels. But the bigger point is that what was the driver was what we might just simply think of as reasonably well-scheduled outages in Norway, because refineries' production tends to go through a maintenance phase during the summer when demand for gas is low. But any threat to supply is being greeted with pops on the upside. But this isn't something that is likely to be a big factor. But warmer weather coming through in Europe, and I think it, you know, there is evidence that the temperatures are rising. And trees are growing in the Arctic Circle that never grew there before. So that tells us it's warmer up there, and farming is taking off in the Yukon, where it was impossible before. So we know that the boreal forest is moving northwards, and that is a pure reflection of a warming environment. I think there's much more argument about what exactly we can do about it, and what would be the best use of available funds, because we have billions of people that are striving for improving standards of living. And ensuring that they have what is required to achieve that goal is going to be one of the most productive ways of reducing emissions, enhancing living standards by cleaning the air. If that also contributes to some of the goals of reducing carbon, that would be, I think, an added bonus. We can think about the smoke that is enveloping the U.S. Northeast right now. And I think Activision had some just wonderful timing with their poster in Times Square saying hell is coming for the release of Diablo 4. And it really does look dystopian. So that was perhaps something that was beneficial for them. But it does help to highlight the fact that there are vast forests in Canada. They've been going through drought conditions. It is curious that so many fires started at this exactly the same time. So I will be watching out to see, was that because of large lightning storms that ignited tinder-like conditions, or was there nefarious intent as well? But the bigger picture here is that there is a lot of hysteria around the climate. And It's not unwarranted because there are conditions that are changing. What we definitely, though, need to do is improve living standards. And as living standards improve, people demand cleaner conditions. And that alone would be an incentive-driven transition rather than the prohibition-driven programs that are being championed right now. And they don't work. Telling people they can't do something is very rarely the best way to get the desired results one might like. And oil prices are in a very tight range right now. So the price is starting to come back down. We're in this very tight trading range, less than $10 for the last 6 weeks, where you have OPEC restricting production, you have slowing global economic activity. So I think that is very finely balanced. And then on top of that, you have rising geopolitical tensions. And eventually, we will have a denouement between the creditors, the debtors, or between the debtors. And that will contribute to a big mess. There will be significant bull markets along the way. And that big mess might be well off into the future. I do think that a recession is absolutely inevitable. We're in a mania type situation, and the technology sector is very overvalued. But it's not over yet. But I am short of Apple because I think that their AR VR is not solving any of the problems with the technology. And I think this is also just another example that we have companies that have lots of cash, they've been spending billions on R&D, and they feel like they have to release a product there, and they feel that they can push this into the market. But I personally cannot use VR for more than about half an hour at a time. I find that the headsets are hot. I don't feel like I want to be spending half my day with one of those on because I'll just be sweaty. My eyes get strained. I don't see that that system has been solved at all. How on earth are people going to be using these for hours in a day? You might spend half an hour using it and then you won't be able to see your screen for another 2 or 3 hours. That's not a productivity enhancer. I just simply don't believe that this is going to ever be anything other than a niche unless there is a massive technological change in how this system is developed, and that is something that is going to potentially be disappointing for markets. So, Apple has launched back up to $180, and it is struggling at these levels. We're right in the region of the all-time peak. The PE is north of 30. The market cap is 2.8 trillion, and I just don't think that this is going to be enough to push it over the hurdle of 3 trillion. Now, if we do have central banks multiplying the size of their balance sheets, then I think it is reasonable that some of these large cap companies will double. I think gold will go wild. I think inflation would become entrenched. And I think that would be a really significant problem. So, the one thing that we shouldn't be thinking about is sometimes you get what you want and it is not what you were hoping for. So, that is, I think, one of the factors that if we do get the monetary and fiscal accommodation that would be required to fulfill the dreams of the stock market. Then inflation becomes really problematic, and then gold goes into a phenomenal bull market, and the dollar goes down in a profound manner. I think it is more likely that this will not be the same kind of repeat of the kind of conditions we had after 2008. I think on this occasion, the monetary accommodation will not be as aggressive, that interest rates will not fall as much and they will rise faster. And only by doing that will they get in control of the inflationary bias. But that would then lead to a significant revaluation of the tech sector. It would be potentially bullish for the bond market. It is likely to be a more benign outcome for the dollar than would otherwise be the case. But because that would also be inhibiting to economic growth, I think the dollar would trend lower. It would still be beneficial for gold. It would be particularly beneficial for the emerging markets, which is what we're seeing from their performance at present. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.